For the past 22 years since the collapse of the Soviet Union, the United States has acted as the world's only superpower. Nowadays, as China and other emerging powers gain wealth and influence, a new world order is taking place in which power is being more evenly shared across the globe. While some see this as having potential for international tension, Kishore Mahbubani, a former Singaporean ambassador to the UN, sees it as a cause for optimism. In his latest book, The Great Convergence, Asia, the West, and the Logic of One World, which is published by Public Affairs, Mr. Mahbubani suggests that globalization and more balanced power can lead to a politically unified world. Mr. Mahbubani is the dean of the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy at the National University of Singapore, and I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show. Hello.
I'm happy to be back.
We often hear that the U.S. is losing its lone superpower status. How quickly is that happening?
Well, you know, in 1980, the United States share of the global GNP in PPP terms was 25%, while that of China was only 2.2%, less than 10% that of the United States. By 2017, which is only 4 years from now, the United States share is going to fall from 25% to 17.6%, and China's share would have gone up from 2.2% to 18.2%. So the United States has been number two economy in the world in PPP terms in 4 years' time.
And how will that affect the United States' role in the near future? I mean, does it matter whether we're 1.5% behind China?
Well, I think, you know, I actually hope, this is a very plastic moment of world history. And what the United States does now will actually determine both the course of world history and also what happens to America in the future. And as you know, I begin the book by quoting a remark from Bill Clinton in a speech in Yale in 2003, where he very, very wisely, Bill Clinton said, if United States assumes that it's going to be number one forever, then fine, the United States can carry on behaving unilaterally. But if you can conceive of the possibility that United States be number two, surely it's in the interest of the United States to build a rules-based order that will constrain the next number two. And this is the greatest appeal I make in my book to the United States. Use this moment to create a rules-based order.
But I guess the question I was asking is GDP the most important factor in determining the world's pecking order?
Well, as you know, there's a very sharp correlation between the size of your GDP and the ability of your things to do things either in the military, cultural, and in other spaces too. So I think, as you know, most Americans, and I describe an incident in the book where in Davos I couldn't get any American politician to talk of America as number two. It's psychologically impossible for Americans to accept the possibility that they could be number two someday. So I actually think it is in America's national interest to realize that with a changing world, you have to make adjustments. That's the message I give.
You also say that new emerging powers should stop pretending they're developing countries. So that's the other side of this coin.
Oh, of course, because I think the biggest danger that the world faces today is that on the one hand, you have a rising tide of global challenges from global financial crisis to global warming to global pandemics to global terrorism. And at a time when the demand for global leadership is rising, the supply is diminishing because both America and Europe feel that they got other things to take care of than the world. And China and India, the two new rising powers, are not yet ready to assume global leadership. And that's a real problem for the world.
But you write about an expanding middle class and increasingly educated world population. Are these trends expected to continue into the future? And will that change the balance again?
You know, one key point I make in the book is that we probably have seen more change in the last 20 or 30 years than we have in the previous 300 years. And we will continue to experience this rapid change over the next 10 to 20 years. To give you one...
Well, 300 years ago, Britain was the dominant power in the
yes.
world. They still have a lot of influence, even though they have a really diminished role.
I think Britain is going to be the fastest diminishing power in the world in the next 10, 20 years. But more importantly, you know, just to give you one statistic of how dramatically the world is going to change in the next 10 years. Today, the size of the Asian middle class is 500 million in 2013. In 7 years from now, the size of the Asian middle class will grow from 500 million to 1.75 billion. An increase of 3.5 times in 7 years, which means in the next 7 years, the new Asian middle class will be far larger than the United States and Europe combined. Now, that's a whole new world that's emerging, and people are not aware that this is happening.
You use your country, the Republic of Singapore, as an example of a success story. Singapore is a city-state with, what, 5 million people?
Yes.
Is success really replicable around the rest of the world?
No, in fact, I don't think we should use Singapore as a model for what is going to happen in the rest of the world. But Singapore in some ways represents what you might call the tip of the Asian iceberg. So what you see happening in Singapore today, this remarkable transformation where when I grew up as a child in Singapore, I grew up in a home with no flush toilet. I was put in a special feeding program because I was technically underweight. And we had poverty in Singapore. We had ethnic riots in Singapore. And it was a city with no hope. Now, that city of no hope, like Ghana at the time, today has a per capita income larger than that of the former colonial master, the United Kingdom. That's a remarkable transformation in my lifetime. So what's happened to Singapore in the last 30, 40 years is now going to be replicated on a much larger scale, and that's why you should look at Singapore.
Well, hasn't Singapore's success come at a price? Many observers have been alarmed by the authoritarian approach of its government. It's a strong state that prioritizes collective welfare over individual rights, such as freedom of speech. And we're seeing something similar in China, for example. Is that the road to success?
Well, I think, you know, in the early phases of development, many Asian states had authoritarian government. And by the way, Hong Kong had a colonial government also where the citizens were not allowed to vote at all. So, but if you look at South Korea, for example, or even Singapore, you notice that as the middle class emerges, the political system automatically transforms itself. And in the case of Singapore, in the last elections in 2011, three government ministers lost their seats. Now, that's if you say that Singapore, the government or party controls the elections, how did three government ministers lose their seats? So a new political environment is emerging in Singapore, and a new political environment is emerging all over Asia.
As in Burma, for example.
Yeah. In fact, the Burma story is quite remarkable.
Well, let's hold off on it for a moment because we have to take a little break. But my guess is Kishore Mahbubani, M-A-H-B-U-B-A-N-I, his latest book, The Great Convergence, Asia, the West, and the Logic of One World. It's published by Public Affairs. We're back with Kishore Mahbubani, his latest book, The Great Convergence, Asia, the West, and the Logic of One World, published by Public Affairs. You discuss the trends that you say are unifying the world. What are they?
Well, you know, if you look at the global population, the size of the middle class globally is growing from 1.8 billion to 3.2 billion by 2020 to 4.9 billion by 2030, which means that for the first time in human history, more than half of the world's population is going to be in the middle class.
In the United States, it's shrinking.
Yeah, it's shrinking relative to the past, but it's still a very large middle class. But globally, you begin to discover that whether people are living in Brazil or South Africa or India and China, they have a common set of aspirations. And the story I tell in my book is about how when my children got admitted to Yale, for example, it was a really big deal. I got congratulatory cables from Brazil, South Africa, saying this is what we want our children to achieve to. And the fact that you have people all over the world with a common set of aspirations, what they want to see for their lives and for their children's lives, shows that there's a great convergence happening in the world that we haven't noticed yet.
And you see the exportation of Western-style MBA programs to the rest of the world as a positive thing?
Yes, it's a remarkably positive thing. You know, what people haven't noticed is that trade has grown exponentially in East Asia. And, you know, of course, trade is growing partly for economic reasons, but it's also growing because the new leaders in East Asia, as a result of MBA programs and other American university education, have a kind of win-win mindset when it comes to economic cooperation and development. And that's a real positive gift from America to the world.
But haven't many complained about the way the West has exported its culture to the to them? It's seen as one of the negatives of globalization by many.
Well, I know you're referring to what they call the McDonaldization and the Coca-Colaization of the world. But, you know, that's in what I call the phase one of the cultural wave. But, you know, as these societies succeed, well, the next phase, what you will see in Asia, is a major Asian cultural renaissance, where ancient societies like China and India will rediscover their past. And the effort of India to revive the world's greatest university, Nalanda University, which was the greatest university in the year 500 through the year 1200, is a sign of societies going back and said, we had a great past, we now want to reconnect with it and rediscover it. That will be the next big Asian renaissance.
Does the West have anything to learn from Asia? I remember the title of one of your previous books was, Can Asians Think? Understanding the Divide Between East and West.
Yes. Well, I think the good news is that, as you know, in the past, the only successful societies in the world were in the West. But today the West only makes up 12% of the world's population. 88% lives outside the West. And I think the success, the recent success of the East Asian societies, for example, in maths and science tests for 12-year-olds, all these things provide lessons for the West to learn from today.
The Western middle class, the lifestyle of the Western middle class uses a lot of energy. We're going to have difficulty producing enough energy for an expanding middle class all over the world?
I completely agree with you. This is why I argue very strongly in the book that the West and the rest must now cooperate to create a win-win world order where we don't have to fight over things like energy.
Well, you say cooperate. We can't cooperate on climate change. We can't seem to cooperate on the UN. The UN was intended to function as a kind of a world government with more teeth than the League of Nations. Nothing seems to be able to be achieved anymore.
Yeah. Well, one of the strongest arguments I make in my book is that it was a mistake for the West to keep multilateral institutions weak. And now that the West is going to become a minority in the global village, it is actually in the long-term national interest of the Western states to drop their old policy of weakening multilateral institutions like the United Nations and now strengthen them so that organizations like the World Health Organization and the International Atomic Energy Agency can then help to protect Western interests in this new world.
But the UN wasn't able to deal with the problems in Rwanda, in other parts of the world, the former Yugoslavia, now, of course, in Syria, often because one country or two countries will veto the wishes of everyone else. It seems it's almost as bad as the U.S. Congress.
Well, this is precisely why I think people should read my book, because I think the U.N. has been one of the most unfairly demonized organizations in the world. The reason why the UN is weak today is not because the United Nations chose to be weak, it's because Western policy made it weak. And especially the P5 members, unfortunately, they are the ones responsible for the genocide in Rwanda. But as I say in my book, they should apologize for that and not blame the UN Secretariat, because the UN Secretariat is just an instrument in the hands of the P5. And if the P5 decided to make the UN Secretariat powerful and effective, it can become powerful and effective.
An article in the Los Angeles Times recently suggested that a space race in Asia could intensify the rivalry between the United States and China.
Well, I think I hope this is where, again, this is one of the key messages that I put in this book of mine, that the time has come for the United States and China not to engage in any kind of new arms race or space race, because this is when they should begin to collaborate with each other and realize that they have a common long-term interest in fashioning a global order where both can benefit from.
And maybe they will, because trade ultimately will probably affect all of that. But what do you do with rogue nations like North Korea?
Well, you know, just last month, the Chinese government voted in favor of a resolution imposing sanctions on North Korea. That was a very powerful signal by China to North Korea. Watch out, be careful.
We have very little time left, but many people who are from the Muslim world object to the imposition of Western values and Western ideas on them. You're suggesting that we're going to change the way they see the world?
Well, actually, you know, I have so much good news in this book, including good news about the Islamic world. For example, people forget that the country with the largest Muslim population in the world is Indonesia. And guess what? Indonesia has been growing steadily at 6%. Indonesia is going to emerge as one of the largest economies in the world through successful, peaceful economic development.
The second largest is Pakistan, one of the most troubled countries in the world.
Yes, but then you have Bangladesh, which Henry Kissinger dismissed as a basket case 30 years ago, and is growing at 6% a year. So there are success stories in the Islamic world that the West must take note of, because those success stories will now percolate to the rest of the other Islamic world.
It seems to me part of your message here is that we've been much too pessimistic and we have to start thinking more optimistically?
Definitely, because the world that is coming is a far better world than we could have dreamt of, even if we had dreamt of a utopia 10 years ago.
Really? Despite global warming and all of the other problems that
we face? There are these challenges, but the capacity of humanity as a whole, the number of people who've been educated, is the largest it's ever been. And this new educated classes will create a better world for us.
But not necessarily in Greece or Spain or a whole bunch of other troubled countries. Unfortunately, we've run out of time, but I thank you so much for being on our show again. Kishore Mahbubani's book, The Great Convergence, Asia, the West, and the Logic of One World, revives that idea of a one-world government. It's published by Public Affairs. It's been a pleasure having you on our show again.
Pleasure to be here.